Coach Giannelli, I'm Jeff Rosenberg, the president. And it's to be your host this meeting. The title of our meeting is "Rearing Minds to the Warriors." It's something very important in our current history and as it evolves with our history of, as Jews in South Carolina. I want to, as president, get to realize that the racist organization knows is its staff. And we got a phenomenal staff. Marty Perlmutter, who heads it up, is executive director. And Idle Sue is out of the desk. She does everything that needs to be done for us. And most importantly, he gave special recognition to having worked with Marty for 15 years. Rachel Barnett, the society program director, who packages everything we do and puts it together and strips us out. Wonderful. Mark Swift, who has been acting as interim executive director, hopefully by a vote of his organization, our new executive director, succeeding Marty. Dale Rosengarten, that beautiful magazine we see two times a year, totally her effort with Alyssa. We got Alyssa Neal. I don't know how many of you know her, but she is and did this for the current magazine. Alyssa, stay up. I don't think so. And I found out just yesterday that Alyssa had an assistant. Taylor, is that you?
Brandon.
I mean, it's phenomenal that we have, as a society, such a staff, and when you look at their qualifications and the PhDs and the schools they went to, this is why when you mention us to other historical societies in the country, they know who we are. This weekend, the planning committee, let me go real quickly, Rachel Barnett, Louis Filler, Ian, Simon Lewis, Marty Perlmutter, Bernie Howard, myself, Dale Rosengarten, Mark Sweet, Alyssa Neely, and Brandon. We're also doing this in association with the Carolina Low Country and Atlantic World, the Charleston Branch and the Association for the Study of African American Life and History, and the College of Charleston's African American Studies Program. And bear with me, I will mispronounce, I will make some errors. Hey, comes with the territory.
Yep.
I also want to recognize past presidents of the society. I'll give them an order of when they were president. Judge Richard Girdle sitting up here on my left, myself, Ronald Rosen, Ronald here, and Dr. Linda Girdle here.
Right.
Edward Hollycock, I saw him outside. Edward. Ann Hellman, Rachel Barnett, in the back, David Drayton, I saw David, and Ernie Marcus. Here we go. Just a quick review, I think everybody has a copy of the agenda. There'll be a 5-minute break between the first and second program, and a 15-minute break between the second. At this particular time, I'd like to call Marty up for just a few brief comments. Marty, make it very brief.
Said, could you make a few remarks about killings? I guess the idea is, I'm leaving and they want me to make fundraising my last act. So let me just mention that the society really survived on the generosity of all of you and others. And the core item of our budget are pillars. And pillars are people who make 5-year commitments society. We haven't worked primarily on endowment, we've worked primarily off of pillars. So this is a parting appeal. If you're all inclined, please join us and become a pillar of the society by signing up for a 5-year $1,000 annual commitment. Thanks.
Thank you, Marty. We try to stay on schedule, a few minutes late as it is now. I want to introduce right now the moderator of our first panel, Shared Memory, Equal Justice. Richard Gergel, federal judge, United States District Court, First District Court, past president of the society, married to past president Linda Gergel. Mr. Gergel, my wife and I met Richard and Belinda when we took a trip to Israel. We took the governor to Israel in 1982. We remained friends and became close again when Isidore founded the society 24 years ago. Richard, please introduce your panel.
I will. Good afternoon, everyone. I want to make a few just sort of comments about our topic, and then I'm going to briefly identify our panel members, but we've agreed that we're all going to sort of introduce ourselves and sort of what our interests are in this topic. And of course, as President Rosenblum has indicated, the title is Shared Memories and Equal Justice of this panel. And that suggests that African Americans and Jews have certain common shared memories. I would suggest perhaps a more accurate title would be Persecuted Minorities, Equal Justice. Because Jews and African Americans have very different and not generally shared persecution experiences. African Americans came to this country as enslaved persons. They were violently taken from their homes, forced to endure the Middle Passage, where countless perished, and then labored in a system of human slavery characterized by violence and brutality. After African Americans were emancipated as slaves, they were forced, after a brief respite with Reconstruction, to live in the margins of society under the indignities of Jim Crow. Many of the vestiges of slavery and Jim Crow endure today, something many African Americans feel that most white citizens simply don't understand. Most American Jews, those who self-identify as Jews, I'd say over 90%, descend from immigrants to the United States who arrived after 1880. These immigrants were persecuted and vilified in Europe, subject to pogroms, forced to live in ghettos, and denied access to property ownership and regular commerce. They came to America to be freed from endemic and often vicious government-sponsored anti-Semitism. Jews were the chosen slave scapegoats of Europe, in the same way that often African Americans were the scapegoats in America. After arriving in America, these Jewish immigrants experienced an additional horror: family members left behind perishing in the Holocaust. As a child, I knew of no Jewish family that I was aware of that did not have grandparents, aunts, or cousins who died in the Holocaust. Further, after arriving in America, many Jews face religious discrimination. But we must be frank, nothing approaching the level of discrimination inflicted on African Americans. Many Jews feel that many non-Jews do not fully understand or appreciate this history of discrimination and persecution, or their fears about the persistence of anti-Semitism in the United States and around the world today. While Jews and African Americans have very different persecution experiences, their histories have heavily shaped their personal outlooks and made them, from time to time, allies. Both have a natural affinity for the persecuted and the underdog. In the 2008 presidential election, 78% of Jews voted for President Obama, as compared to 34% of white Protestants. No other group of white voters remotely approached Jewish support for the nation's first African-American president. Jewish involvement in the civil rights movement is also well documented, including participation in the founding of the NAACP and in civil rights campaigns in the South during the 1960s. But there have been moments where African-Americans and Jews have been in conflict, each believing they have been misunderstood by the other. Therefore, discussions such as occurring here today are helpful so that these longtime friends and allies can better understand each other, address areas of conflict, and identify important public policy issues of common interest and purpose. So with that, I would like to give the briefest of introductions to our folks here, some of whom are old friends and some are new friends. Sitting to my immediate left here is Armand Dörfner, who I knew as soon as I began practicing law in South Carolina in 1979, because Armand then, even then, was a legend among us. He was a mentor to those who fought for social justice. And all these years later, you still are a hero to many of us.
This comes from being old.
Armand says it's going to be old. I don't think so. Another old dear friend is Dr. Bernard Powers, a professor of history at Columbia College of Charleston, and an author of what I consider to be the greatest book ever written on Charleston, Black Charlestonians. And I'll tell you a story about Bernie that just highlights a little bit about perceptions of white folks and black folks on some of the similar issues. Some years ago, my wife, who was then president of Historic Columbia Foundation, invited Bernie to come up and give a talk about the burning of Columbia. That is a periodic event in Columbia where people talk about how horrible it was, the burning, all the people running from buildings, oh, it was terrible. Bernie comes up and says, you know, to African Americans, it was a day of jubilee, right? We were free.
Yeah, that's right.
And you know, wow, all these white folks with their jaws dropped. It was a completely different view, and it was like God's wrath on the slaveholders. It was just a wonderful moment. I'll never forget that lecture. And Bernie remembers it well himself.
I do.
Next up to Bernie is Dr. Claire Curtis, a member of the political science department for over two decades at the College of Charleston. She is active at KKBE and is very active in the community. And next to Claire is Reverend Joe Darby, another old friend of mine from Columbia. We have fought many battles together, Confederate flag and other issues, when Joe had a church in Columbia, and I had brought a lawsuit to bring down the Confederate flag, and we have been on many panels together. I've been to his church and spoken, and he is an old and dear friend. And the end is a new friend, Reverend Charles Hayward. Good to have you here, Reverend, who has been the co-president of the Charleston Area Justice Ministry and is a passionate advocate for fairness and justice. So I want to ask each of the folks to briefly introduce themselves beyond what I have done. And Armand, I'll start with you. You want to start? Okay, Reverend Hayward, you want to start at your end, and we'll go down the list here.
Charles Hayward, retired pastor of the St. James Presbyterian Church on lovely James Island. The congregation happens to be the largest of our African American congregations in the Presbyterian Church USA. Presently assisting a smaller congregation on Edgestone Island to refocus. I'm born and raised on John's Island and a product of the Charleston County educational system. Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Good morning, I'm Joe Darby. I'm a presiding elder in the AME Church. Got all kinds of community hats falling all over the place, from first vice president of the NAACP, former board president for the ACLU, one of the founding pastors of the Justice Ministry, along with Reverend Hayward. Delighted to be here. I'm a Columbia native, but I've been learning to be a Charlestonian for the last 20 years.
I'm Claire Curtis. As Richard said, I've been in the political science department here for over 20 years. I teach political theory in a lot of classes that are justice oriented, and I have been involved in the Charleston Area Justice Ministry for the past 7 years through the leadership of Rabbi Alexander. KKB was one of the founding congregations of the Justice Ministry. This year, I'm the co-chair of the steering committee of the particular issue that we'll be fighting for on Monday night, which is affordable housing.
And I am Bernard Powers, again, member of the History Department at the College of Charleston. I've been here for about 25 years, soon to be professor emeritus in about 2 weeks, so after I get my grading done. And I am very much interested in the history of African people in South Carolina and really around the Atlantic world. And obviously, if you have an interest in this subject, you're also interested in larger issues of equity and social justice and the interaction of people representing different racial groups and ethnicities and so on and so forth. I am also a member of the board for the International African American Museum that you all undoubtedly have heard a lot about, and we are very hopeful that we'll be able to open the doors of that new institution in about 2 years. So it'll be an important memorial site, an important site of memory and conscience, as well as an important educational facility here. And we expect that that there will also be some social justice work that will routinely occur in that place. So one of my greatest, I think, though, claims to fame is the fact that Reverend Joe Darby over here to my left was my pastor for over a decade. So thank you very much. Glad to be here today.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. I'm Marvin Durfer, and I live here in Charleston. I've been a civil rights lawyer here and other places for, I guess, about 50 years, focusing heavily on cases of racial justice, which I think is the most lasting problem we have. I came to this country when I was 2 years old with my parents. We escaped from the Nazis in France, and growing up, half the people that I knew had blue numbers stenciled in their arms from concentration camps. So that's part of the background that I brought to whatever I do today.
Let me posit a question, and Bernie, we'll start with you on this. I began the discussion here talking about how the persecution experiences helped shape the African American and Jewish communities. I'd love your historical perspective, how this persecution experience has helped shape the sort of character and nature of the African-American community, particularly in the South.
Okay. Well, that's really been a process and a long process of persecution and recovery, beginning with, obviously, the very shore of Africa, where people were captured and loaded on board ships and brought here to not only a distant, but a very different place. And then the whole institution of slavery, we don't think about it in this way, but we need to. Slavery has characterized American life for more than freedom, for a longer period of time than freedom has. We don't think about that typically as Americans, but we need to. And not only slavery, but you know, when you ask people about the institution of slavery, which is a tremendous way of a tremendous means of negating the personhood of people as individuals and a people collectively. And I know that you all in the audience and others up here on the panel understand that and understand that very deeply. But you know, the thing about it is, if you ask someone about the institution of slavery and its purpose, and if you tell them that it had two purposes, they would immediately get the one purpose, but the second purpose would be frequently and usually more difficult. And people would immediately understand that the system of slavery was designed to force people to work. Yeah. But it was designed to do something else too in America, and it was designed to regulate race relations. And of course, then when you say that, people say, oh yeah, of course, because it was a race-based system, which means then that, of course, after emancipation, you've got to have a mechanism or a series of mechanisms that are then designed to continue the maintenance of that second function, the regulation of race relations. And of course, that becomes the system of formal or informal Jim Crow. And of course, the civil rights movement then arises in order to challenge that system of disfranchisement and Jim Crow. And again, when people think about Jim Crow, legally established or informally maintained the system of racial segregation.
Bernie, tell them, just because you and I use the term, define sort of what Jim, the nature of Jim Crow.
Yes. And so, of course, the system of Jim Crow was typically legally established racial separation amongst people, where African and exclusion. And so African Americans were typically excluded from certain places, for example, in the city of Charleston, from parks, and there were separate entrance ways and exits, and people were excluded from the Francis Marion Hotel, for example, and if you wanted to go to a restaurant and were African American, you might be served if you went around to a window at the back of the restaurant, and separate parts of the theater set aside for blacks and whites, and so on and so forth. But it was a system, and again, people don't really think about this until they're told, until it's brought to their attention. But the point is, this is a system that was not merely designed just to separate people. It was designed really as an educational device, in the sense that you could look all around Southern society in particular, and you could see the places where people were assigned to be and the places from which they were excluded. And this conveyed important values with regard to who was valued, who was most valued, and who was least valued in society. And that spatial separation was designed to convey that lesson. So everywhere you looked, that lesson was affirmed, and that lesson was taught. And it was a deep humiliation. And so unless you understand that aspect of Jim Crow.
It was subjugation.
Yes, it was.
Systematic subjugation.
Absolutely. And it was an extension of one dimension of the institution of slavery. And so that system, of course, has only recently been challenged. If you think about the civil rights movement of the 1950s and the 1960s. And so here,
you grew up in a system, as did Reverend Darby and Reverend Hayward, in a segregated society as children.
Well, I grew up in a de facto segregated society, because I'm from Chicago.
Okay.
So it wasn't Jim Crow. But in the North,
I'll tell you, I grew up in Columbia. Yeah. I know how Reverend Darby grew up.
Yeah. But in the North, it was just a difference in character. There weren't signs about, but for example, you knew which neighborhoods you could buy a house in, and which neighborhoods you couldn't buy a house in, and you knew which neighborhoods you could safely walk about in and which ones you better not be found in if you valued your life. So it was a very similar situation, but there were important differences. And so I'll just conclude by saying that this goes back, Judge, to your initial observation about, yes, there being shared forms of oppression, but there were significant differences between the Jewish experience and the African-American experience. Final thing that I will say is this. In thinking about the relationship between the two groups that we are talking about here today, historically, the relationship between the two groups has been a contentious relationship. And it's been a hierarchical relationship in which the whiteness of Jews in America has been the predominant factor. And it's only really been since, I would say, the early 20th century, flowering during the period of the civil rights movement, that there's been a real cooperative and fruitful relationship between the two. But what happens is a lot of times when we look at the past, we take that quote-unquote golden age of cooperation and we interpret the past through that present lens. And we want to be careful when we think about the past and the
It's interesting. I know that that many scholars of American Jewish history have looked in vain for Southern Jewish abolitionists.
Yes.
They don't exist.
That's
okay?
Right. That's right.
Didn't exist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting, just a little bit into the weeds on Jewish history, the early Jewish settlers were mostly Sephardic Jews from Spain and Portugal, descended from Spain and Portugal, and were refugees from the Spanish Inquisition, and German Jews who faced their own form of persecution, but they came and they kind of blended into American society,
yes.
Didn't really challenge things,
yes.
Were chameleons.
Yes.
The most of the folks here, I would say, what percentage of the folks here, families came from Eastern Europe and Russia? Just raise your hand. See, virtually everybody, okay? And that experience was very different. Their families did not arrive until after basically 1880.
Mm-hmm.
And they had their own persecution experiences.
Yes, yes,
and
yes,
they
yes.
had, as I mentioned, and Armin dramatically said that half the people he knew had mm-hmm. Tattoos on their arms mm-hmm. for having been Holocaust survivors. Mm-hmm. I certainly had mm-hmm. Friends of mine whose parents had tattoos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so I started that question. Let me ask Reverend Darby this. How did this experience, slavery and then Jim Crow, shape the African-American community?
It shaped the community in positive ways and in negative ways, I think. There were coping mechanisms. You still had to live in the South, or in the North, in America for that matter. You learned then how to do that and how to survive. When I was a child, my mother warned me. We lived on in a community called Wheeler Hill, not far from the University of South Carolina. And parents, like my mother, would warn us not to go up on the university campus after night fell because medical students would grab you and experiment on you. And she confessed to me later on that wasn't it. The plan might grab you and you'd never be seen again. You learned that you would have. Bernie said, I lived in Columbia. Columbia was Jim Crow Central. So you went to the back of restaurants, the black restaurants. There were a couple of theaters for black folk. There were a couple of theaters that admitted black folk to the balcony where we were able to take aim with ice and popcorn and other stuff. You learned how to cope. I have two sons, but both of them I had the same talk that they talk about these days. Because the wave of what's happening now with police and African Americans mm-hmm. is not new. We just have recording devices in our pockets now. And I told both of them very frankly what to do, how to conduct themselves so that nobody felt compelled to fire a warning shot in either one of their heads. That's the reality of how that's worked out. It's also given a wonderful sense of resilience to the community. The African Methodist Episcopal Church, a church that was established as a protest in Philadelphia against an effort to make black folk have second-class religion, rather than tolerating that. A gentleman named Richard Allen and some of the other founders simply walked out and established a church of their own. Every time I hear people ask, why do you have to have a black this and a black that, I have to remind them that at one time there was no ability to join an American Medical Association. So there was a National Medical Association. There was a National Bar Association. There's African Methodist Episcopal Church. And it's interesting when folk try to process that. Had a United Methodist pastor once in the conversation suggest to me that since things had changed so much in America, it might not be a bad idea for the African Methodist Episcopal Church to merge into the United Methodist Church. And I reminded him that we actually were established in 1787, but the United Methodist Church was a merger of Methodist bodies from 1968. So maybe they needed to merge into.
That's right.
Let me ask you this, Armin. What is, in your perception, to be the influence of the persecution, of the Jewish persecution, on shaping the views of the American Jewish community?
I think it's a significant thing, and it reminds me that we are at a crucial time today, because I think a little persecution, and frankly for most white people, a little persecution goes a long way.
For empathy.
Well, self-empathy. When I was growing up, Jews were not really first-class citizens in this country. We were not quite second-class citizens. We were a little bit better than that. But when Jews came to this country in the early 20th century, a lot of people thought Jews were feeble-minded, were morons, were criminals, were filthy, smelly, everything you can imagine. And so we were really way down. As the years went by, the discrimination lesson became a little more polite. It's not really been until the last probably 20 years, 30 years or so, that Jewish people in general have been regarded as first-class citizens by the mass of Americans. And that can make a difference. I can imagine that for black people, one of the most frustrating things has to be the American experience. The American experience is that people come from foreign lands where they were persecuted or poor or criminals, or convicts or whatever, and they come to this country and they make a new life and they throw off the trappings of the old and they become real Americans and first-class citizens. And so people who come later after slaves have been here for hundreds of years leapfrog over them. And so people from various countries in Europe, now even in Asia, seem to become first-class citizens, while African-Americans are still struggling here, very far from being first-class citizens. And you can look at other immigrant groups. I'm not trying to point to anybody. But a lot of immigrant groups back in their own countries had histories in the early 19th century of being strong abolitionists for American slavery. When those immigrant groups came here, over a period of years, some of those feelings tended to fade. And so Jews are a little bit unique in having held on to that sense of not simply persecution, but empathy a little longer than non-Jews. But I think it still takes a little persecution to keep reminding us that it's still out there. And in that sense, I think one of the topics that's referred to here is the Charlottesville incident. And in a sense, it's helpful to Jews to know that even though it was a small group of crackpots, there are still people out there yelling about destroying blacks and Jews together. So to my mind, that helps concentrate the mind and creates some attitudes that can be, frankly, unfortunately, very necessary and helpful for the future.
Reverend Hayward, let me ask you this question. The growing up in Johns Island, different in some ways from Columbia, experience of Columbia and Charleston, Chicago, how did that experience shape this rural, if you talk about the most intensive discrimination, the most difficult discrimination, certainly rural African Americans were at the least power, were the most powerless of the group. How did that shape the rural African American community? Which, by the way, at the end of World War II, 75% of African Americans lived in the rural South.
I reflect from my own personal experience to say that I felt protected mm-hmm. when I grew up on Johns Island. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's about 18 miles away from here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because there was a tripod community, home, church, and school. Mm-hmm. And so that environment was a protective environment. And as Joe was saying, you were certainly educated about manners, how to interact with the white community as children. But I ventured out of that safety bound when I was one of those who participated in the integrating of the schools in 1965. So traumatic experience that has been for me that my wife says that I'm suffering from some kind of post-traumatic stress from my high school days. And we've been married 45 years. And I'm just beginning to agree with her. And my illustration is that over these past, I've graduated from St. John's High School 50 years ago this spring. And I haven't been on the campus more than 6 times. I pass by all the time. But my experience there with my white counterpart has done something to me about not venturing into that environment. So I would say if that's my experience. And in rural America, what Joe said earlier about, you know, somebody got missing, that you don't see them anymore. Your uncles, your cousin, your best friend, your high school buddy that ends up dead on the side of the road on Monday morning after going visiting his girlfriend on Woodmore Island, and then you discover 6 months later, 9 months later, that was not an accident, that was a murder. And so in rural America, we had a protection that we knowingly had to extend ourselves beyond that protective border. And so the caution, the camaraderie built among ourselves, and certainly to avoid the interaction as much as possible. I grew up on the farm. I started working on the farm when I was 4 years old. I remember my mom and dad getting paid $1.50 for my day-long work on the farm at 4 and 5 years old. On one side there was a protective environment in our community, but you were certainly prepared and equipped for venturing outside of that protective zone.
Yes, Reverend Dar.
Yeah, I wanted to add for contrast between me and Hayward. I went to Booker T. Washington High School in Columbia, all black school. After 1965, I did that by choice after consulting with my mother because that school meant a lot. Booker T. Washington High School closed in 1974, but it still has an active alumni association, active reunions, sponsors, scholarships, does all of those things because there is an ethnic identification with the school. And that was a part of the positive. I went to a school that actually was the first accredited public school in the state of South Carolina. Went to a school where the teachers who otherwise would have probably been in other professions in a different South Carolina had two options for professional service, either preaching or teaching. And so I had master's and PhD level teachers. And that identification helps to shape as well. Same thing is true of college. I went to South Carolina State for a year and a half, marched on the March 101, had a wonderful time, figured I better get out of there because I was having too wonderful a time. So I transferred to Carolina. But for many years, if someone asked me where I went to college, I would say, I'm a graduate of the University of South Carolina, but I'm an alumnus of South Carolina State University because that's where my heart lies.
Dr. Curtis, let me ask you about there was this mention of Charlottesville.
Mm-hmm.
What is the sort of perception you have of the impact of Charlottesville on the consciousness of Jews, blacks, society at large?
I mean, I think part of what's interesting here, and it's something that I believe Armin said earlier, is that if you look from the perspective of whether you call it the alt-right, white supremacists who are self-identified, very much sort of hardcore white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, there's very much a sense that blacks and Jews are in the same position. Right, and so the degrees of hatred against both groups are going to be the same. But I think part of what is then interesting coming out of Charlottesville is a kind of the question of threat, right? What does that threat potentially mean? And I think the threat for African Americans coming after Charlottesville is adding that degree of extremist violence to a society that already has a degree of kind of normalized violence. Mm-hmm. Whereas for Jews, I think what that is a society that doesn't have a sense of normalized violence against them, that doesn't have a sense of threat, but that there are then these pockets of extremism and this question about what to do about those pockets of extremism. And I think so, you know, in my non-scientific qualitative research that I did with my two children this morning. Do you as Jews feel a sense of threat in American society? And their answer was just no. I mean, there was no sense, there was no talk that needs to happen. Now, on the other side, what they don't necessarily actively talk about, and this comes back to this question of persecution, is they very much understand themselves as the other, right? If you were a Jewish teen in South Carolina going to public school, you are absolutely in a tiny, tiny minority, and you are surrounded by Christians. And that experience, I think, shapes Jews in a way that then intersects with this question of feeling oneself to be other, but does not necessarily intersect with questions around threat.
In both the Jewish and African-American religious experience, the Exodus story is a very important piece of the gospel, right? Of the religious view of the world. Jews annually, one of the most important holidays is Passover, celebrating the liberation of Jews from Egyptian slavery. The Exodus story obviously had a powerful resonance in America with the Emancipation Proclamation, etc. And it had, and African Americans had their own Exodus story. How does that theology, that view, shape the communities, and what does it sort of promise us sort of for the future? Bernie, why don't you take a shot at that?
Okay, and let me also announce this. If, and Reverend Darby, you probably saw the announcement about James Cone, who is the really the father of Black liberation theology, passed away today. So we just received that notion, that announcement. But yes, this notion of Exodus is a terribly important one for understanding the African American experience, and we can certainly think about it in two ways. One is the hope for an eventual liberation and the restoration of freedom at some point in the slave's life, either close to the then present or at some distant point in the future. And that was something that enslaved people believe would happen. In other words, they believe that there would at some point be this revolution in the affairs of this world, and that the whole order would be changed, and that liberation would come. And of course, right here in the Holy City, we can see the products of that hope for liberation and Exodus if you just look at some of the Black churches here in the city that date back to the period immediately following the American Civil War. Because what happens during the war is, of course, when the first shots of the war were fired, African Americans heard the sound of freedom. They heard God's voice in those cannons that were fired, and they believed that the war could not come to a conclusion without also bringing about their liberation. And then after the war, we see this major exodus of African Americans from white churches, and in some cases from white denominations, to then churches that they created themselves, and then had the opportunity to lead full and complete religious lives. And so it's really at that point in time, for example, in South Carolina, where the African Methodist Episcopal Church really begins to flourish, although it had an existence here since actually beginning in the early 19th century, but it was a very short-lived denomination because it was an abolitionist church and destroyed in the wake of the discovery of the Denmark Vesey slave conspiracy. So this notion of Exodus is tied very directly to the liberation of Black people and a hopeful future that people continue to believe in, and it was a source of their survival.
Armin, how about the Jewish experience of social activism, and particularly you as a civil rights attorney? How was the, what was the role of the Exodus experience in terms of shaping a worldview?
I think it's mostly symbolic, because part of the problem is it's hard to get, feel immediacy with a, I'll call it a legend, that's 3,000 or 4,000 years old. And in fact, what may be more immediate, but that we in some way fit into the Passover service and the Exodus experience, is the persecution, we all keep using that word, that took place for 2,000 years, and took place especially in the late 19th and early 20th century. Most of the Jews who came to this country around the late 19th and early 20th century were escaping a group called the Cossacks and other vigilantes in Europe who were, in those days, not so different from the Klan or the Knights of the White Camellia in South Carolina, who just went around killing Jews. And then it came to its ultimate place in World War II, when fully half or two-thirds of all the Jews in the world were murdered, because one man took over and persuaded the whole nation that these people ought to be killed. The Nazis weren't much more happy about black people or homosexuals or anybody else who was deviant, but they focused on Jews. And so I think, in a sense, it's more that experience that shapes us, but that we fit into the Exodus legend.
There was we've talked a little bit about the liberation gospel and Exodus and the view of African Americans and Jews. How does that experience, how should these groups not directly affected by the issue of immigration and of suffering of people who are refugees, how should our communities respond to this human suffering and this human condition that's happening right before our eyes? What responsibility do we all have to face those issues? And I'm talking about the Syrian refugees and so forth. Claire, you want to take
it? Sure. I mean, right? Of course we have a responsibility. They're fellow human beings who are being persecuted in ways that we should find very familiar. And in that sense, I mean, I do think for many families that part of what the Passover experience and the Seder is about having conversations about people who are experiencing these kinds of moments of unfreedom, radical unfreedom right now, and what that kind of emancipation might look like for them, but also what responsibility Jews have to build a better world and what that better world would look like, not just for Jews, but for others who are experiencing that kind of persecution.
Reverend Hayward, how about the view in terms of sort of liberation gospel, liberation philosophy, and African-American responsibility of embracing the suffering of others?
Well, we have a story to tell through that whole sense of suffering, pain, disenfranchisement, denial of personhood. And the African-American community has always been affirmed. Yes, having a strong back, being able to succeed, accomplish first this, the first that. But I think it's a speaking to our humanity and the need for all people of good conscience to do a self-examination, place themselves in the uncertain, the unfortunate circumstances of being oppressed by others. Can you for a moment, for a time, for a season, for an experience, place yourself in the footsteps and experience of somebody else so that your own humanity can be challenged to take you to another place, a higher place. And I think the African American community has done that. So often you hear the tragedies and folks say, well, I forgive you. Let me tell you something. You can carry the hate and anger in your heart and it'll destroy you. And so I think we have an obligation, a responsibility to share our narrative and encourage people to be self-transformed for a greater cause and a greater healthiness and humanity.
Reverend, I think this is a good opportunity. We had mentioned in our conference call the other day that you were going to share with us a little bit of background about the Charleston Area Justice Ministry. And once, I think it's a good opportunity to talk about that.
The Charleston Area Justice Ministry, and we're in our seventh year, it's a diverse collaboration of congregations, the mosque, the synagogue, working together to identify those challenging and pressing issues that befalls our community. We began with Micah 6:8, what does God require of you, what does the Lord require of you? To do justice, to love mercy, and to walk faithfully with your God. In our faith traditions, we do well with the mercy ministries. We make sure the hungry are fed, the thirsty get clean water, the naked get clothes, medical care, whatever those temporal needs are, our mercy ministries do well. We do well in our faith ministries. 52 times a year, we attend worship. 365 days a year, we probably be doing some kind of praying. We attend our monthly organizational meetings in our faith traditions. And so we are very faithful. But where we have failed in our traditions is to do justice. In other words, to put ourselves on the line for the cause, the well-being of those who cannot speak for themselves. And even if they did, they wouldn't be listened to. And so the Charleston Area Justice Ministry has come together to identify those communal problems, to look beyond our religious traditions, and to see that we can identify a common problem that is injustice towards humanity. And by working together, we do the necessary research of what that problem might be. Dr. Claire just mentioned on Monday we'll be talking about affordable housing and the 211,000 folks who live in our region who can't afford it. I'm not talking about public housing. I'm talking about having a full-time job and still yet not being able to afford quality housing. And so we research regionally, nationally, what has been some of the best practices in resolving these communal problems. And then as Nehemiah in chapter 5 did, the circumstances there was when the famine hit, these families could not grow crops, they could not produce a harvest, they had to go in debt to feed the family, the famine continues, and now they can't pay the debt, and so the lenders can do what? Take their property, charge interest, take their children. And so Nehemiah comes in and says, oh wait a minute, that's not lawful. And so he does the intense research, and what he does, he could have done mercy ministries. He could have offered up debt training, and he could have opened up food pantries and clothing shops, and he could have even, in fact, he did advise on personal financing. He could have been faithful, but he sought to do justice. And what he did was he called together this great assembly of the community, people who were genuinely concerned, and then he had coming before them, the text says, the officials and the nobles. The officials, those who were elected and charged with the responsibility of caring for the community and deciding. Certainly the nobles, those who could sit behind the scene and simply make a telephone call. But he called them together before this great assembly and charged them to do what was just, to return the interest monies as required, to return the properties that were required, and to return these people's children. They agreed. And so we believe in the justice ministry, and we can get the community on the same page to identify and agree to the problem. If we can identify a faithful solution that has been practiced somewhere and another community has proven itself, and we should be able to bring our public officials in to this assembly and charge them with doing what is just for all, regardless of religious background, regardless of your race, whosoever needs to experience the fullness of their humanity.
I know you have a particular interest in that.
I do, but Reverend Darby is
good. Good.
The thing that's remarkable about the Justice Ministry, and I think we have folks here from all over, if you're talking about some kind of initiative that the type that the judge was talking about, working together to share problems, so wonderful model. because there's a group in Florida that planted the ministry. And when they sent someone up to talk with me about what they wanted to do, I said, that is not going to work in Charleston. And I called the then pastor of First Scots Presbyterian, Reverend Haywood, then pastor of Holy Communion Episcopal, and all of us agreed, this is not going to work in Charleston. And it worked, because the model starts off with people getting to know each other first, talking about what the problems are, narrowing those down to a specific problem annually, doing the research, and then focusing on that problem to come up with real solutions. So it's a model for what can happen when people really get to know each other and find out that they do have shared experiences and shared desires to make a change.
And I... Yes.
Why don't y'all give the details for that?
Yeah, so I actually have some tickets in my bag if you'd like to come. It begins at 7 o'clock, although doors open at 6:15 at Mount Moriah Baptist Church in North Charleston, and we hope to have over 2,000 people there. And I just wanted to follow up on two things that Reverend Darby just said, is that about kind of the empowering nature of the work that's being done here, because I think that empowerment works in kind of two ways, that first of all, you get ordinary people in the community talking to people that they would not otherwise talk to. So across congregations, across class lines, across racial lines, which I think is just amazing. I mean, so you meet people and talk to people that I do not meet. I don't meet them at Kickabee. I don't meet them at the College of Charleston. And you get to have experiences with people that you don't ordinarily get to have experiences with. But I think the second piece of this that's so empowering and that is such a powerful example about how to respond to issues around persecution and injustice are the ways in which, when we talk about this idea of doing research, is that it's the people who are involved in CAGEM that are doing the research. So it's not that people identify a problem and then sort of put those research experts in charge of trying to figure out what's going on. So that when we're doing research to identify what affordable housing or the lack of affordable housing looks like in Charleston, what we do is establish, set up a series of meetings with the people who are the people in town that know the most about this. And then 8 to 10 members of the CAGEM community will come to those meetings. And so you have a meeting with somebody like Jacob Lindsay at the Department of Planning, and there he is with a person who's a spokesperson asking him questions, but it's all the members of the community are there to participate in this research and to participate in the very process of bringing about the change. So change is not being handed to people, but people are involved in bringing about that change themselves. And so that's part of what becomes incredibly empowering and what brings about justice as opposed to simply a kind of policy band-aid.
I just need to acknowledge that Dr. Clear just mentioned a ticket. That doesn't mean you have to pay for a ticket.
Oh, that's a good point.
It's not a paid event.
Right.
It's free. We ask everybody to complete a ticket so that you identify who you are, who invited you, and what congregation or community you are connected to. That's the reason for a ticket.
Yes. And it allows us to prove to the press that there were as many people there as we would like to say were there.
And let's talk just a second about the house. Y'all been studying hard this issue of how there was an article in the New York Times several weeks ago, I'm sure everyone noticed this, that North Charleston had the highest eviction rate of any city in America, right? How did that happen? And talk to us a little bit about the nature of this problem. I think you have an interested group here.
Yes. All right, so, I mean, anyone who's been in Charleston for any amount of time recognizes the degree to which we're, A, extraordinarily popular place to live, and B, becoming more and more and more expensive. And so 57% of renters in Charleston County and 40% of owners of homes in Charleston County are what's called cost burdened. That's where this 211,000 number comes from. And to be cost burdened is to spend more than 30% of your income on housing in any given month. And so you can imagine the more that you're spending on housing above 30%, that's money that you don't have to go to other sorts of things. The particular group that we're interested in is people who are making 50% or less of the area median income. So in Charleston, that's roughly $34,000 for a family of four. Because for those people, they make too much money to qualify for public housing, but they don't make enough money to be able to afford a place to live, whether it be a place to rent or a place to own. And while the city of Charleston, for example, is doing things around affordable housing, a lot of the talk around that is for people who are making 80 to 120% of the area median income, what's called, and I think this is a really unfortunate use of language, what's called workforce housing. Let's be clear, people who are making under 50% of the area median income are workers. And in a tourist economy, let's be clear, they're also essential workers, because if we want people to go to hotels, that means we need people to clean those hotel rooms. If we want people to go to restaurants, that means that we need people to wash the dishes in those restaurants. And the people that are doing those jobs deserve to live in houses that are not necessarily, which is no offense to Hanahan, in Hanahan where they have to commute 40 minutes on the road, but in fact can live close to where people work and close to where people live. And this issue, and this has been, again, part of the Justice Ministry, one of the interesting kind of pieces of the research that we did and the discussions that we've had in the community around this, is that affordable housing in the Charleston area absolutely intersects with the question of gentrification and the radical change of neighborhoods downtown, of neighborhoods on James Island, of church congregations who have had to move because the people that have traditionally gone to those congregations. So New Tabernacle Fourth Baptist is no longer on the corner of Elizabeth and Charlotte Street, but is in fact in Goose Creek, because that is where the people who had originally gone to that church now are living. And so affordable housing in Charleston is not just an issue for people who are not making enough money. Affordable housing in Charleston is an issue of gentrification and the racial whitening of the peninsula of Charleston.
Armin?
Yeah. I want to bring up another aspect of that, which is not the people who are so poor. That's a serious problem. It deserves all the attention and more that we can give it. But there's another group of people, and that is African Americans who currently own property or have recently owned property in the Charleston area. Right now, say the east side, especially. And that's property that is now going to be phenomenally valuable, and somehow we know that in the end it is not the African Americans who live there who are going to reap the benefits. And one of the real problems of quote racism or whatever we want to call it over the centuries is economic. It's what slavery was an economic engine. It was an economic engine that was made to work by making certain people, well, millions of people, other and inferior. That's what made the economic engine work. And I know I sound like a Marxist or a communist in this sense, but I think it really was economic. And so now we know, for example, and this may be a little bit off the topic, but the gap between income, the gap in income between white and black people today is significant. It may be as much as 2-to-1, or if you talk
growing.
It probably is growing, but more important, it's the gap in net worth. The gap in net worth, which is what you own, is 10-to-1. 10-to-1. So if you're a college graduate as a black person, the odds are that you may be making a salary that is within reach of your white colleagues, but in terms of net worth, which is what you send people to college on, which is what you allow your children to take unpaid internships in the summer rather than having to get a job, which is what you send your children to Europe with, is just enormous. And it's been built up over centuries, because two-thirds of the gap in net worth comes from intergenerational transfers. Not simply what you leave your children in a will, if you have a will, leave a house, but it's your uncle paying for a vacation trip. It's a family member giving a kid a car. It's all those things. And so I know it's crucial to get people housing, to enable people to have housing, to enable people to live in Charleston, for example. But it's also crucial to know that the opportunities to climb the ladder are just as important as getting onto the ladder in the first place.
If I could add,
please.
just a little bit onto that. It also shows how things interweave. And the best example for those of you familiar with Charleston's community called Wagner Terrace. When I came to Charleston, Wagner Terrace, a lot of the members of Mars Ground lived in Wagner Terrace. That community has totally gentrified. And it used to be a Jewish enclave, I believe, before it became an African-American community, because what's now Greater St. Luke Avenue Church is what used to be the synagogue. It's now in West Ashley. The way that it works is insidious, because I know a few of the black folk who still live over there, and they get, no exaggeration, at least one and sometimes more calls or letters a day saying, do you want to sell your property? Please let us buy your property. So that gentrification process can be completed. It spills over to education. Philip Simmons is the elementary school. James Simmons is the elementary school closest to Wagner Terrace. At one time had an appreciable Jewish population. After there was flight, it had a black population. It closed for seismic repairs. While it was closed for seismic repairs, the neighborhood gentrified. When it reopened as a Montessori school. And a lot of black folk came warm and fuzzy with Montessori. So it's obvious what the intent was in that. If you go not far from here, right down where they're going to build a museum, that area once was home to a massive African American community. After Hugo, it was pronounced uninhabitable. It was too polluted to live on. Where all of those condos going in now, somehow they're able to miraculously mitigate that and build those things. If you look at the Cooper River bridges, the old bridge and the new bridge, the footprint of both bridges in Mount Pleasant is the same place. The footprint in the peninsula caused the destruction of another hunk of black community. All of those things tie in, and that's the racism of the day. It's not the folks who are marching with the stuff in Charlottesville that most worry me. It's the folks with the big wallets who sometimes smile at people and say, I really know what's good for you, and I'm here to help.
Let me just add one thing to keep at this. The importance of this notion of income and net worth. I was representing a black college one time. One of the problems at the college, which is unfortunately true at a lot of black colleges, was a high dropout rate, what they call a low persistence rate. And we did a study, and there were interviews of leaving of students who left. And that turned out to be money too, because the students who were leaving in huge numbers gave financially related reasons. It may be that something happened at home and they couldn't stay, they had to go home and help. Or if it wasn't that, it was the fact that if they didn't have extra money to tide them over an emergency, that would be a problem. Or having to work. More of the students had to work more of the time. If you're working more than 30 hours a week, you're not going to pass your courses. So that even the students who dropped out for poor grades, there was money was a problem there too. So I can't emphasize enough how built into the system, quote, the system this is. If you look from beginning to end, it's staggering how much of the problem comes back to money and how much of the money problem comes back to who you are.
Mm-hmm. And the lack of net worth, net income has little or nothing to do, in my opinion, with being lazy. Mm-hmm. It has everything to do with being the last hire and the first fire. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't control your own economics of building institutions that can hire your folks and give them summer jobs and intern training opportunities to teach them how to own and operate their own business as entrepreneurs, you're still always struggling with asking the majority to simply level the playing field. Just give me a fair opportunity to prove that I can do that job or even better as anybody else. And so the last hire and first fire has much to do with not being able to build generational network.
Mm-hmm. How about from the audience? Anyone have a question? Yes, in the back.
As to the comment about the goodness of the public officials, and an apology to Judge Durbo for this, it may stand up before one of your judges. The
By the way, Judge Seymour is here too, so
the Carter of Shame case went through the South Carolina courts for 22 years. They finally got a unanimous decision of the South Carolina, almost unanimous decision of the South Carolina Supreme Court, ordering the legislature to bring the funding for education, for primary education in South Carolina up to the constitutionally mandated minimum quality level of education. It has been almost 5 years since that decision, and the South Carolina legislature has not allocated anywhere near the amount of money that would make that decision a reality. Some could argue that that's a violation of the, at least the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution in a denial of due process. But I have a big problem with justifying the actions of public servants in South Carolina when instances like that are repeated over and over again, both in local councils and in the state legislature.
Anybody wish to respond to that? Amen.
Yeah.
It's been 5 years since the decision, but it's been 20 years since the case began.
Yes.
Well, and just one thing to throw in, I don't know if this is part of why you were saying this. So in this Nehemiah action, this idea of asking public officials, we have no, we're under no illusion that public officials who say yes to us out of the goodness of their hearts. They just say yes to us because, and they don't always say yes, but they say yes to us because they're in a room of 2,000 of their constituents and the newspaper. And so that's, I mean, I think a lot of this, what it takes is public action to say this will not stand. And the problem is there are far too many actions, I would say, in South Carolina where not enough of us are willing to stand and say this will not stand.
Yes, I would care.
Yeah, just to build on that a little bit, the, I'm involved with the entire Cradle to Career, which just put out its fourth annual report on the state of education in the Tri-County area. Nothing has changed. We've got some wonderful public schools, and we have some public schools that are not educating people to any acceptable level. And I think the group's conclusion at this point is that we can complain and point at the teachers and the principals and these other people that are running these schools, but until the community itself demands more, we're not going to really get much change. It is a problem for all of us. So I would be interested in what the panel has to say about how one can galvanize public opinion energy behind the idea that the schools are the responsibility of all of us.
Reverend Darby?
Yeah, one of the reasons the Justice Ministry is a success, the thing that's going to happen on Monday for me and my action, we'll have probably around 2,000 or more folks at the same place. Now, elected officials, if they can't do anything else, my apologies to any elected official who is present, but elected officials can count. And if you're talking about 2,000 potential voters, they can be very cooperative when they put their minds to it. I think the challenge for us, again, is one of the places where African Americans, Jews, everybody can collaborate, is registering and turning out voters. We have to elect some politicians who do not want to get elected simply for the sake of getting elected. If you look at some of the campaigning that goes forward now, it's ridiculous. We now are talking about what we're going to do to be tough on sanctuary cities in South Carolina. There ain't no sanctuary cities in South Carolina. We're talking about combating voter fraud that does not exist. And there's people who simply want to get elected and try to push just little buttons in order to get elected. That's why I give, quite frankly, I try to be as nonpartisan as I can be.
So I have some of my Republican friends fits when they talk about how appalled they are with the present leadership in the White House. I say, you know, no. Your party has been whistling the dog whistle all of these years. You just finally got somebody who came with a bullhorn. So if we elect the right people, that's where it starts, and that makes a difference. South Carolina's cut taxes to the point that roads are crumbling, schools, as has already been said, are not going anywhere. You've got one guard responsible for 200 prisoners in a maximum security prison. You have to elect the right people, and you have to turn some folks out.
A few more words about education or rather. You said such important things and such true things about problems with discrimination, but the disparities in racial achievement in the public schools in Charleston and across the state is the most insidious form of discrimination. Educators know how to resolve the problem. Just looking at Eden Street schools here in Charleston is one example. Until the education system is addressed and corrected, we will always need more affordable housing. We will always have more people in prison. We will always have people who don't have jobs. But once that is addressed, that main source of ills in our community, everyone's life is going to be a lot better.
Do you want to go first?
Yeah, we could spend the rest of the evening on this one. Charleston Youth Justice Ministry, one of the first things we did was to challenge the school district about an average of 280 4- and 5-year-olds sitting at home rather than being in classrooms. So we challenged Dr. McGinley and the school district to open a classroom. They said it couldn't be done at first, and it was a budgetary matter. Couldn't be done by August. By opening the school, and then subsequently we got it done in January when we went back to school. But that was a collective research by the Charleston Youth Justice Ministry. You said, you can do this if you had a will to do it. We also addressed the issue of the suspension of our children from the classroom. 1,600 kids going from the classroom to the jailhouse. We challenged North Charleston, and Mount Pleasant to find an instrument that our officers could use to evaluate the behavior of our children. This is bad behavior. It's not criminal action. Why are our kids going to jail? Well, we succeeded in getting them to agree to that, and that's been a great reduction of expelling our kids from the classroom. Listen, there is a law passed in 1834 that made it illegal to educate black people. Not only would a person of color who was caught be flogged and charged a fine, but even slave owners, if they educated their slave, that same spirit exists today in the South Carolina education system. Don't educate black folk. Now, if a kid can go to school today in South Carolina, if an African American child can go to school in South Carolina, from K-4 to the 12th grade and never have a black teacher, reverse that for me, a white child going to school from K-4 to 12 and never having a white teacher. Can you imagine that? None of us can go there, but that's what we have in South Carolina. Sisters and brothers, it is my firm belief and my experience is that there is a systematic effort, and if it's not the officials, they're the nobles who can make the telephone call and keep us in a segregated system so that all of our children, black, white, Native Americans, Latino, Asians, are not getting the best of education in South Carolina.
And just to follow up, I mean, another initiative that KJM did was around suspension rates in schools and changing the systems, which Charleston County School District has now changed to a system of what's called positive behavior intervention and supports. and a system of restorative justice which lowers suspension rates. And we might think like, yes, how is that a racial issue? We know that African-American kids at extraordinarily young ages, kindergarten and first grade, are expelled from school. And so, first of all, we have actually addressed quite a few education issues, but also to say one of the interesting things in those years, those multiple years that we brought up education issues, often what public officials would do on the stage at the Nehemiah Action is to turn around and point the fingers back at faith communities. This is your job. This is your job to be making sure that your kids are polite enough, making sure your kids can sit at a desk. Why aren't you doing something? So I think there are a lot of issues that need to be addressed. Every year we can only address one.
You know, one of the things I do, and I know Judge Seymour does this as well, is when we take guilty pleas, we ask the young men, who are invariably young black men, how far did you go in school? It's rare to have someone who has a high school diploma. This dropout rate is a direct path right into the state and federal court system. It is a tragedy of the first order. I once read this article which distinguished among many distinctions between African Americans and Jews. Is that African Americans was a crime for generations, not just for a brief moment, not for generations, to read and write. And no matter how bad it got for Jews, there were always people of the book. Mm-hmm. They always read. So we could go back 10 generations in our families and Jews, we had readers. Mm-hmm. Well, 10 generations in an African American family, they were criminals if they were reading. And if you don't think that has a continuing legacy today, mm-hmm. you don't understand history. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Thank you.
Other?
Right there.
One final question.
Yeah, yes. We'll do one more.
Yeah. Yes. Say something, bring this up and keep the panel honest. I think one of the biggest problems that we're facing also when it's sort of having these issues in isolationism, and that's the idea that, if it doesn't affect me directly, why should I care? You know, what happened to our dear brothers and sisters during the Holocaust, what happened to African Americans for several hundred years, that's not a racial issue, that's a human rights issue. And unfortunately, the people we count on to lead us in these efforts refuse to demonstrate leadership. And what's impressive is the young people, like the civil rights movement workers for young people. They're showing the courage to do what needs to be done. And we just need to, we gotta have more of that, I think. We don't want to deal with it if it doesn't affect us directly, unfortunately. But, it's not a racial issue always, it's a human rights issue. So that's frustrating to me, but I think it's tied into what y'all bringing up today.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Mark, gentleman here, can you get a microphone to him?
My understanding of the way schools are funded is that it's largely through the county. So if you're in a poor county, you're going to have poor funding for the schools, and consequently, it's going to be a perpetual kind of situation. And it would seem that a solution to that would be that we need to have, let's say, a statewide education tax that now gets disproportionately added to the poorer counties. Because unless we're dealing with something like that, we're talking about something that's philosophical but not practical. We need something on a practical level where somebody is going to somehow get voted into office on the basis of increasing taxes such that somehow we can have the poorer counties funded better. Mm-hmm. Or is there another solution that otherwise we're all sounding nice of what we'd like to do, but we're not coming to a way to fund it?
Mm-hmm. See, I think it still revolves into electing the right people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you don't do that, then you can tell the difference.
And you can tell when, quite frankly, white privilege comes into play. One of my best illustrations of that is BMW. South Carolina fought hard to get BMW to come to South Carolina. We got BMW. The main reason BMW came to South Carolina was the deep water port of Charleston. But they didn't build their plant in Charleston. They didn't build their plant around 95. They didn't build their plant in the Midlands. They built their plant on the far edge of South Carolina, where you're almost in North Carolina, because that just happened to be where the governor at that time lived. And so if you go down I-85, you find the best schools because there's a heavy tax base locally. If you go down I-95, you find trees. And the way to correct that is to elect people of goodwill to public office. You know, if we don't get the right folk in this election, in the present political climate, I don't know what it's going to do.
Well, with that, thank y'all very much.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Not a week since.